Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here as always with my friend and my colleague and my co-host, starting offensive lineman for the Indiana Hoosiers.
There it is.
Ronnie Kurtz.
There it is. Yes, I am not the starting offensive lineman, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you. Did you ever play football?
I did. I played high school football for just a little bit.
What position did you play?
So I went to a small high school. Okay. So we
played both sides of the ball?
We played like Iron Man. So I did punt and kick return.
Oh, whoa. All right. Special teams. Okay.
That's right. And then I was quarterback for a year and cornerback for a year. So when you go to one of those.
Did you call your own plays? Or you had
coach call our plays.
Yep. Did you have the little Velcro?
No. It was like pass or run.
like Tecmo Bowl.
That's
the
right.
The old school Tecmo Bowl. I want this run or that run. This pass or that pass. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, was it something that you enjoyed doing?
I love sports. I love competing. So just in general.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
How about you?
I played peewee football for 1 year, but basketball was the sport.
Okay.
I enjoy watching football more these days.
Yeah,
but basketball was the sport that I played.
Baseball was mine by far more.
Gotcha. Yeah. What positions did you play?
Pitcher. Yeah, for most of my life.
Man, you just got the arm.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
pitcher.
Yeah,
you could have been a top prospect.
Something like that. You know.
Yeah. Speaking about top prospects, see, there's a transition in the banter.
That's good. Even in the banter,
I'm going to make a prediction for the Super Bowl.
Okay.
I think this episode comes out 2 weeks before the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Super Bowl is February 8th. I think this is January 28th is when this episode will drop.
Okay.
And so I did this once before, and I did not look it up, but there was, back when you were the co-host before, so this would have been, 5 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
4 years? A while. I made a prediction based on when the episode was going to drop that, hey, by the time this comes out, the Patriots will have won the Super Bowl, or Tom Brady. I forgot what it was. But it came true. Like, it was a prosperity gospel thing. It might have been when Brady was with the Bucks, I think. And so I want to do that today because we're coming hot off the wild card win.
That's right, Drake May.
Wild card win was last night by this recording. And so I'm wearing my Patriots hoodie.
Yeah.
And I'm going to predict that Drake May is taking these Patriots, that they've, you know, they've been counted out. They've been, you know, sold out for an easy schedule that they've been told. But I think they're going to gut it out and they're going to get to the Super Bowl.
You're not predicting they're going to win. You're just going to predict.
I'm going to predict that they're getting there.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
They're going to be in the Super Bowl. So when people hear this episode, they're going to be like, whoa, Jared was right.
Or they'll be like, cold takes exposed.
maybe so. But I want to be bold and I want to claim. My wife, she insists that I'm not positive enough. That I don't that I'm too cynical and pessimistic.
You either have zero or 1,000.
Well, that's true. And so when we were watching this game last night, I was like, oh man, like they can't do it in the red zone.
Yeah.
That's like, I was like, the red zone's a dead zone for them. And she was like, you're being too negative.
Yeah.
Like, you know. And so I thought, you know what? She's probably right. I need to be more positive.
I'm just glad as a Patriots fan, you don't call it the red area.
Why?
Tom Brady.
Yeah, because of the red area.
In Belichick, apparently, they call it the red area. And I don't know why, but when I hear it on the broadcast, I'm like, I hate this. It's the red zone.
Do you think they're doing that to be different?
Or
do
I don't know. I don't know, man.
Is there a reason they would call it that?
If there is a reason, I haven't heard it. But they do. They don't call it the red zone. They call it the red area.
I mean, that almost sounds like you're going to the doctor. You're like, I've got this red area. That doesn't sound. Red zone is more of a football term.
You don't watch red Scott Hansen on
medical condition.
On NFL red area.
You know what? I want to watch red area right now.
That's
That's like the Mayo Clinic.
Exactly.
That's like, WebMD or something like that. So, well, you know, I've learned something about you, this football thing. And so today is a grab bag episode.
Hey.
We're going to learn some things about each other.
Another amazing questions. Jared Wilson transition. You know, I saw the other day someone tagged Ligonier Ministries and was like, can we get 20 minutes of R.C. Sproul just angrily drawing on a chalkboard. And it's like, I don't know if you know, RC like was famous for using his chalkboard, and he wrote aggressively. And so it's, it's, I'm not kidding you, it's 20 minutes, no talking, of him just going, you know, all around the chalkboard. And it's hilarious.
Wait, like continuous take?
Yeah, just no, just like chopped up. Yeah, chopped up. Okay. So what I want eventually is just a chopped up all of Jared Wilson's transitions.
Well, our comms team will have to get on that. It's not like they need
more things to do.
But
anyway,
that
grab
would
bag.
Be interesting. Yeah. So the idea behind the grab bag, we haven't actually, you know, done one in a while, but the idea behind the grab bag is we each bring two questions for each other, and they're surprise questions.
Yeah.
There's no prep.
Makes me a little nervous.
As though we're out on a high wire here. There's no net.
A lot of trust.
So and we get to decide, are we asking serious questions, or are we asking, you know, funny questions or light questions.
All right.
Or is it a mix or what have you? We'll have to.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you the first question.
Okay. All right.
Most people who know you, especially in terms of your public ministry or, you know, public face, as a theologian, I'm curious to know, was there a particular transition when you became more theologically minded? Could you tell the story? And maybe it was at your conversion. Maybe you were always just kind of a bookish guy.
No.
So tell me how, after conversion or soon after, or whenever it was, tell me the story of becoming interested in theology.
Wow.
And academic kind of pursuit.
Yeah, I wasn't ready for that. That's a good one. No, that's a good one.
Okay.
That's how we do these things. Let me give somewhat of a condensed version so I don't make this episode too long. So I have shared some of my story in other episodes, but didn't grow up in a Christian household, as far as I know, first Christian in my family kind of thing. Extended family, there seems to be some, you know, residue of faith, but just in my immediate family where I grew up, that wasn't really the deal. So I came to know the Lord in high school through a faithful preacher named Mark. And after I was converted, I would read the Bible and I would just write questions down that I had. And I had a lot. I mean, I didn't know anything. I remember, I tell this story in my class often. I remember the first time I really tried to like sit down and read the Bible. I didn't know where to start, you know. No one was like there to like hold my hand and do it. So I just let it fall open. And I was like, I'll just let the Spirit lead me, you know. I didn't even know what that meant yet. But I like let it fall open, and it opened up to the title page, the New Testament. And I remember thinking, what does that mean? Like, if there's a new one, is there an old one? What's new about the new one?
Why does this book have the old thing in it?
Didn't realize I got an updated version. Yeah, yeah. Like, I didn't know anything.
Okay.
You know, so I actually tell that story at the beginning of all of my theology classes to say, between there and getting a PhD in systematic theology, I can probably relate to wherever you are. So, like, just exhale.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're here, you know. So we've said this before on the show a few times, but what I learned pretty early was the more I learned about the Lord, the more I loved him. I did not grow up a reader. One of the biggest changes, one of the biggest conversions that happened in my conversion story was that I became bookish.
Yeah.
I was not bookish as a kid.
I've heard this so many times.
Yeah, I was not bookish. I mean, I like had like Lemony Snicket as a kid or like Harry Potter, but that was about it, you know. I was not like my kids are already like, they live in books, you know. I just wasn't that. I was sports. But became converted. I had a severe shoulder surgery. That's a tongue twister.
Okay.
My junior year of high school. And
I
had
a red area.
Yeah, a little red area on my shoulder here. And it made me just like, you know, basically bedridden. And my pastor bought me a few books, some that I would not recommend anymore, some that I would.
Okay.
But it kicked up a little bit of a love of reading, kind of for the first time. And that, like, hey, the more I know the Lord, the more I love him, really took off. Hmm. And so I actually, my first, like, I went to college, my first, like, academic exposure was, I remember the major dates of the Old Testament clicking into place.
Okay.
Like 722, the Assyrians, 586, the Babylonians, and, you know, 931, the kingdom splits. And the dates fall into place, and all of a sudden the Old Testament makes sense. I'm like, whoa. I can like see this a little more as a narrative. And so that was like my first taste of like, I think I might want to do Old Testament. And so that was the original plan, was Old Testament studies, particularly the prophets, and pursued that in my undergrad, took a whole lot of Hebrew, really loved it, got into graduate school, came to Midwestern, and realized, even at the end of my undergrad, realized I liked theology a little more than the rest of my friends did. All of my friends seemed to be going in the direction of biblical studies, which was great. I love biblical studies, but I seemed to be going in the direction of theology.
For the listener not clued in on academic things, what's the difference between biblical studies and
theology? Biblical studies is going to, you know, it's going to tune itself to the way the words go. Whereas theology is going to tune itself to the way the ideas go.
Okay.
So think of worm's eye view, crawling through the text, versus a bird's eye view of getting the big picture of the text. So that's unjustifiably short, but kind of a quick. But I realized I'm a systematic thinker. I like to see the whole. I like to see the parts. And the more that those pieces started coming together, the whole thing just felt more beautiful. And so, so it was kind of a, I think it's Lewis's analogy. It was more of a sun coming up than a light switch moment, where I was like, I recognized I might have some proclivities towards academics.
Yeah.
I might have some proclivities towards reading, definitely some proclivities towards being structured and systematic. And so, yeah, that's kind of how it kind of went.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Thanks for asking.
Well, it's somewhat poignant that you started with this, you were hobbled and kind of, there was a fellow, at our church a couple of years ago whose conversion came about because of a sports injury.
He was
at home, and it was a pretty traumatic injury. He was like almost in traction for a long time, and so almost immobilized for months. And of course watched a lot of TV, but watched a lot of YouTube, and so kind of went down YouTube rabbit and came across Paul Washer and John Piper and some of that stuff, and just that was how he heard the gospel for the first time and felt even a call to ministry.
Amen.
And everything through this experience. And I thought, man, if he hadn't had his leg blown up, you know, in football, I think it was.
Yeah. I remember once, I remember reading Knowing God by Jack Packer and thinking, I don't know who Jack Packer is, but his God is bigger than mine and I want his.
Packer's a good example too, because he had
his head injury.
And his parents bought him like a typewriter or something, and they didn't want him. They kind of coddled him after that and didn't want him to be in danger going outdoors or something. Yeah. And he ended up having to.
And they found John Owen.
He became J.I. Packer.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
Wow, all right. Yeah. Okay. What's your first question for me?
Do you want the serious, the more heavy one, or the more light one first?
Look, you're in the driver's seat of the question, so I don't dictate what.
We'll start with the lighter one first.
Okay.
And this is more like selfish for me, honestly. Trying to get some help here. Okay. Whether in sermon writing or book writing, do you deal with writer's block? Is that a real thing for you?
Yeah.
And then if you do, how do you get over it?
The answer is yes. I think sometimes writer's block is misunderstood. For me, it's usually a brain fatigue. It's not really like, I don't know what to say, because I write in my head so much.
Yes.
That it's very rare for me to sit down at a blank page, and sometimes you're kind of fumbling around like, this isn't the best work I've done, but it's rarely that I'm staring at a blank page and I just have no idea what to put down or how to get going, because I'm sort of pre-writing so much. It's like, but there are times where it's just I've hit a wall, and I think a lot of it is just fatigue. It's weariness. And the best, I think, antidote is not just rest, but for me also activity, getting out. If I go for a walk.
Yes.
Which is why, and I think it's also why some people they say, the best ideas come when you're taking a shower or something like that. I just think there's something about the activity, the freshness of it, that kind of hits reset.
Yes.
And so for me, getting outside, going for a walk, exercising, something, that usually does it. And it's why I think we talked about this before, the best times of day to write.
Different.
Yeah. So first thing in the morning is not great for me, because I'm usually there's a brain fog there.
Yeah.
And so it takes me a while to kind of.
That's why we record in the mornings.
That's right. it takes me a while to kind of get going. So I almost have to have that fog kind of cleared out. So I have to be up probably for an hour or two before I get to work, because I need that sort of space to kind of wake up fully, feel fresh, clear things out. I'm not a morning person, so to speak. So it's harder for me. But in the story life, I talk about writer's block as almost spiritual warfare too.
And yeah, so I try to like look at it from different angles. Even if I don't have the experience myself, I think the best or one of the best practices for people who have that kind of, I don't know what to say, is just to start saying things. Just start writing and write through it. Mm-hmm. Write garbage, write things you're gonna throw away. Write a couple of pages, because most writers I know, they hit a, you don't hit the groove, you know, right when you start. Yeah, yeah. Even if you do, you know, even if you do know kind of what to say, it, your best writing comes at, while you're in kind of the rhythm of mm-hmm. it. So, you know, in writer's block, just start writing, and it's not going to be good, and you don't know what you're talking about, but just that kind of the fluidity of the of the work itself and the rhythm of working, you kind of hit the jet stream while you're going.
Yeah. That, I think that's a really good point, because especially in sermon writing, it's less. I guess it happens in book writing too. Yeah, I can't say that. But in sermon writing, I often find that like the unction comes because I worked through a little bit of like.
You just have to start. Just
like,
start.
Yes. So I always like tell, you know, like the young pastoral residents in our church, like don't hate what the Lord is doing in that moment when your cursor is like blinking at you. You know, he might actually be working in you, and and you're like pausing and like really having to wrestle through either what you're reading or what you're trying to say could be the thing that he uses to bring like the light and heat, you know?
Yeah. So the hardest part for me in sermon writing is the very beginning, like the introduction, or what I call the thematic introduction, which is like the very beginning, even before reading the text, because I'm wanting it to be, it's gotta be short, it's concise, at least for me. And it has to be kind of setting the stage. And so when I give myself those constraints, it makes it a little more difficult. You can't just like, hey, let me just get some stuff out.
Yeah.
I'm thinking two paragraphs maybe. And so I'm like, man, it's got to be really like tight. It's
got to
be provocative or intriguing or something. And usually I'm writing that last.
Yeah.
If I sit down and have to start with that, it takes me a while to get going, because that's the hardest part for me.
Yes.
But
Sermon
writing is a little different because there's always that deadline. I mean, unless you're working like way out in advance, but for me, it's like, I don't have time to have writer's block.
No, that's right. You got to go.
You got to go. You know, you got to preach that on Sunday morning. So, you know, you've got to get something out. But also I kind of write it in parts too. So it's very different than like a book where, you know, I might be writing chapters out of order, but typically I'm writing somewhat chronologically from beginning to end. With a sermon, I may like, oh, I've got some thoughts right off the bat I want to get out for point two, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm just writing it all kind of out of order sometimes. So that's sometimes that's harder to get into a rhythm when you're doing that.
This is like not overly brilliant. It's a really practical piece of advice, but it goes with the first thing you said about just physical movement. I found this, I was at a paper store in Columbus, Ohio, in downtown Columbus, and I found this like
a paper store.
Yeah, it's like a higher end, like journals,
like a
papers,
stationery
like store. A stationery, okay. Like pins, that kind of thing. Anyways, I found
you
this.
You lead a fascinating
you know,
life,
come on. Just a man
with
of
your high end coffee and
something
your,
like
I
that.
I just
yeah.
picture you in this kind of aesthetically manicured world. You're like a Wes Anderson.
You know, I do love beauty.
Unto yourself.
Maybe a little too much. But anyway, so I have this little notebook, and it literally fits in the pocket of my shirt.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it's like a perfect little, you know, almost just like a Sherlock Holmes kind of like a writing clues down. But what I do when I hit those like writer's block moments is I will leave my office, and if it's nice enough, walk outside, and I will not come back until I have the next two lines. And I just take a pen in the next two lines often is enough for me. If I start typing the next two lines, I'm back in the rhythm and I can keep going. Again, it's not overly brilliant, but sometimes that happens in like 5 minutes and I'm back in my office right away. Yeah. Sometimes I'll do a lap around campus and I'm like, I don't have anything.
Yeah,
still.
You gotta get out sometimes and just
That's right.
walk around a little
yeah.
bit. And, yeah.
But just having like that goal of like, just think of the next two lines. That feels doable to me.
Next two lines, okay.
And it works.
That's good.
So, yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Well, maybe I'm getting some clues here for my second question.
Okay.
Which is, if you were not doing what you're doing as a professor, or I'll even take pastoring off the table.
Okay.
If you weren't
yeah.
in ministry, per se, like vocational ministry, what would you want to do? Like, what would be a dream
yeah.
job? I remember hearing a pastor once talk about on Mondays he daydreamed about driving a milk truck, you know?
That's not mine.
Well, it's not mine either, but I like, what is your,
yeah, what is
when
your,
you daydream of like, yeah. oh, maybe I could do that. Like what
okay,
what
so
would you do if you couldn't do what
you're
doing?
I feel like
doing?
You're going to laugh a little bit at this, but I think 7 or 8 years ago, this would have been a really hard question.
Oh, okay.
Where I was like, homelessness? I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Like a hobo, a traveling.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little easier now. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I would be in a similar vein. I think I'm built to be a professor. I really do think that.
Okay.
But I would be an English professor.
Oh, okay.
I really think that's what it would be. I don't know that that would have been obvious to me.
Yeah.
I think 8 years ago, I would have said something that was a little more intellectually useful.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm an English professor. What are you talking about?
Well, there's a lot of people who are like, I love reading poetry or reading fiction. And I even one day would love to write like a theological defense of the useless, you know, because people are just consistently like, I know, people are of the useless.
For audio
yeah.
listeners, he made finger quotes around useless.
Right. Yeah, okay. That's right. You know, it's like, why are you reading so much poetry that's useless? And I'm like, man, we think of uselessness very differently.
I was thinking like useless people. I was like,
No. Or why do you read so much fiction that's so useless? You know, and we have this like bent towards the pragmatic.
Yes.
That doesn't have any.
The impractical.
That's right. Yeah, the impractical. Right. Yeah. So I think I would have, you know, 8 years ago, maybe said something like law. Where I could still use my mind, but in a more, maybe a monetized direction.
Yeah.
But now it's pretty clear to me it would be an English or poetry professor.
Okay.
Yeah. Just, I mean, when I'm not doing theology, that's what I want to do is I want to be reading fiction. I want to be reading poetry. And it's enough to like be motivating, you know, so.
Yeah. If I had to knock you outside the academia world.
Okay.
Because that's a fine answer, and it makes total sense. Yeah. But I was really hoping for, like, man, I want to be a charter boat captain.
Like
for,
something you know, totally
I
don't, different.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not telling to make something up.
Yeah.
Just like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. It's still adjacent.
What's the milk truck version?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I don't think there's
that different from a theology professor.
Like, it's just a different
big,
book.
Dream big, Ronnie Kurtz, you know?
Yeah, I guess if I was doing, like, totally different, nothing to do with what I'm currently doing. Maybe something in like sports journalism.
Okay.
That would be pretty fun. Like baseball beat writers to me have the coolest job in the world.
I'm picturing you with like one of those old timey hats from the 40s with a little paper in it that says press.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And you're a typewriter.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's like, I think baseball beat writers have like the coolest day job in the world, you know, so.
Very cool.
I don't know that I would have a skill to do it, but that's, I would have the desire to do it.
You're one of those guys. Don't you actually like keep the stats? Don't you have like a notebook that has the box scores? Did you get that at your paper store?
That would be awesome if they sold like really nice, you know, baseball track keeping.
I bet you they've got those out there, like leather bound.
I do. I love that you started that off with, you're one of those guys.
I'm not a baseball guy.
I caught a disease because I keep score.
It seems odd to me. It seems like baseball is the kind of sport that people like for reasons other than the actual sport. It's either the nostalgia, like it's Americana.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, man, you know, going to the ballpark, getting a hot dog, hanging out with your son.
I was literally thinking last night.
I've been to baseball games. They don't watch the game. Everyone's talking, and then there's noise, and everyone looks up to see what happened.
Whoa. That is a type.
You guys have got your notebooks open, right? So the analytics guys are also like, they're treating baseball like it's the Fibonacci sequence or something. And they're, you know, the intricacies of everything.
Like, you know, I was thinking last night when I was watching Patriots Chargers.
Yeah.
Patriots won.
Yeah.
I wish I had a way to keep track of what happened in individual drives.
Oh, you know, it drives me nuts. Like, when they throw out these stats, like they'll say, you know, the Patriots have never won on a Sunday when the sun was on the.
Yeah, I'm not like, talking about that. What I'm talking about is like in this game.
Yeah.
There's been. I love when they show the graphic where it's like field goal, punt.
Oh, right.
Touchdown. Turnover on downs, fumble. You know, I love to see that, like the evolution of that particular game's drives. I would love like a baseball version of, you know, like keeping track of drives, which I'm sure like the coaches in the upstairs have it.
I don't watch sports to have work to do. It sounds like you're turning a game into homework into a math class, and that's just not how I want to watch sports.
I get it. It's weird, but.
Okay. Well, good. All right.
Here's my last one.
Okay.
It's kind of a two-parter, so feel free to only answer one if you want to.
All right.
What is something theologically that you have changed your mind about?
Oh, interesting.
And the follow-up is, this is going to sound odd. I know you're settled on all of the you know, the orthodoxy or Baptist, et cetera. But if someone told you like 10 years from now, hey, Jared, you used to believe this, but you don't anymore. What would be a thing that you learned that you changed your mind on that you wouldn't be shocked about? Does that make sense?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't understand the question.
Like if someone told you in 10 years you have a different eschatological view.
Someone told me today?
Someone told you
10
yes,
years ago?
Yeah. Someone today? Told you today in 10 years you'll have a different eschatological view. And you'd be like, oh, it's not surprising. Or would that be like, wow, I must have like had like a life altering thing. So there's two questions here. The question is, what have you changed your mind about? And what is something where it's like you wouldn't be shocked if you changed your mind on it over the next 2 decades?
Oh, interesting. Okay. Changing my mind is easy because there's just the natural process or I guess a logical process of, for a kid like me who grew up in the church and, you know, this is before, you know, when I was in high school, college, like the word deconstruction was not,
yeah,
we didn't know what that, like no one was talking about that. And so it wasn't about deconstructing the faith, but it was about like, do I just believe these things because my parents told me, or do I actually believe them? And so for me, it was not a question about the you know, orthodoxy. It was not a question about the basics of Christianity. I've never, even in like my lowest moments, I've not doubted that by God's grace. I've struggled, you know, in my belief and, you know, and I've been depressed and everything else, but, and I've been in sin, in deep sin, but I've never disbelieved that God was real, that that Christ, you know, was real and died on the cross, etc. But, you know, when I was in college, I was thinking through some of like the secondary and tertiary issues, and in particular eschatology, because I grew up in kind of a dispensational premillennialist household, and you know, preacher of rapture, that whole deal. And in fact, even my my conversion story is connected in some ways to kind of the preacher of rapture, like paranoia and things like that. So the Lord even used it, you know, but it injected my sense of faith with a kind of fear and neuroses. But yeah, I started wondering, like, I was being exposed to opposing viewpoints. So I had a friend, my best friend, in fact, in high school, who he was the first guy I knew to leave dispensational premillennialism. And in the beginning, it was more of like a historical premillennialism. We didn't really have that category, but it located the rapture, so to speak. It still separated the second coming from this idea of like a secret, you know, rapture. It still separated those out as two different events, but it located it. It was more like a mid-trib or almost a post-trib. Mm-hmm. It was called the pre-wrath view. And I've only met like one other person who'd ever even heard of the pre-wrath view. And subscribe to the pre-wrath view, but it was my doorway out of pre-trib and kind of the dispensational pre-trib type stuff, because it was asking biblical questions like, well, what about this? Why isn't it in the book of Revelation? And, you know, all these sorts of things. Pre-tribbers, we read the book of Revelation so literally, and yet the hallmark, the linchpin of our view is this pre-trib rapture, which they say is metaphorical in Revelation when John gets called up into heaven. It was like, well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And, you know, you got stuff like Paul saying this will not happen until the man of lawlessness appears, you know, so the chronology just seems really wonky. So I started kind of abandoning my pre-trib stuff and made a journey through kind of eschatology. And it's been a long time since I've really studied it in earnest. Today, I would say I'm a fairly comfortable calling myself an amillennialist. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that I'm inordinately focused on to where if somebody was like, hey, give me all the hallmarks. Yeah. Like, I just believe the Lord's going to return.
Yeah.
You know, I do think maybe there'll be a time of great tribulation before that occurs. But in general, I'm just glad he's returning. And so I changed my mind that the like Reformed theology, that was a huge deal.
You talk about that in pastor justification?
Yeah, yeah. So like when I grew up, man, I didn't know what a Calvinist was, but I knew it was bad. Like I would hear people talk about Calvinism or Calvinists, like Like they were communist kind of, like, I think he's a Calvinist. You know, it was like that kind of thing.
Don't get too close.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, and I remember even like my parents talking to, or my dad saying something to my mom, because we had a youth pastor in when we lived in New Mexico. And I loved this youth pastor, and he was a great guy. And my parents really loved him as well. But I remember my dad saying something to my mom, like to the effect of like, you know, Chris is a really great guy, or he's a good teacher or something like that. But I think he's a Calvinist. And it was like that landed in my ear, and yeah. I was like, "Oh, this must be bad."
Yeah.
You know, like I don't. And so, when I was in college, I was working at the Baptist bookstore in Nashville, Tennessee, in downtown Nashville, and I worked in the books and Bible department, and I was just, you know, it was a default Arminian basically, yeah. Right? And I had these two, you know, coworkers there who were best friends. One was a Calvinist, a Southern Baptist pastor. The other guy was a Free Will Baptist pastor. And they would have these debates constantly on you know, on that issue. But the debates, like my exposure to it was, these were two guys who loved each other, yes. And were best friends. Their wives were best friends. And,
that's amazing.
And so it wasn't really like, you know, there wasn't a lot of animus or you know, there wasn't a lot of you know, animosity or, you know, or rancor between them. It was fraternal. And even though it was good natured, even if they were kind of ribbed each other or kind of provoked each other. And so, like, my lunch breaks, I would just, like, be a fly on the wall while these guys would have these debates constantly. And in the beginning, of course, like, I didn't go the whole way that Free Will Baptists do, because they believe you can forfeit your salvation. Like, I believed, I guess, most Southern Baptists are, like, two-point Calvinists, kind of. We believe in original sin. We believe in, we say once saved, always saved, but, like, mm-hmm. perseverance of the saints. Yeah. So, like, I was a two-pointer, I suppose. But I was with the Free Will guy on the question of, like, regeneration or just, you know, yeah. And was like wanting him to, but over time I was like, man, this Calvinist guy, like, he's winning.
He's, you know what
I
mean?
Like, I had to admit, I was like, man, he's like, he's got more Bible verses. I mean, he's just like, if we're just doing a proof text thing, like, he's winning this deal.
And, yeah.
At some point I took him out to lunch, and we went to a McDonald's just down the street on Broadway there in Nashville. And, I said, all right, I just got a bunch of questions. He was like, okay. And I just started peppering him with every question I had.
Yeah.
And by the end of that lunch, I was pretty well like, okay, I think he's right. And he recommended I read R.C. Sproul's Chosen by God.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that that's the best book on the subject, but it was the book that kind of...
Yeah, for you.
I was already on the edge, and Sproul's Chosen by God just like pushed me right on over the edge.
Yeah.
And then even then, Ronnie, like I believed it, but I didn't like it.
Yeah, it was sort
of like, I think this is true, and I don't want to be wrong.
Yeah,
I'm that kind of guy. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to be right, and so I think this is what the Bible teaches. But I did not have a sense of emotional acceptance of it. It was not a comfort to me until my life fell apart, and then it was like, oh man, it might be Owen. Absolute sovereignty is what I love to ascribe to God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just was something so, yeah, it became a pillow for me and not just a rock of something to believe in. So those are a couple
That's
of
a great
examples.
Answer, yeah.
I'm trying to think. The whole time I was talking, I was like, the other part of my brain was going, what is it that if somebody told
me
today,
I mean, it sounds like eschatology could be one.
It could be that. Like if somebody said, hey, you're going to go back to historical premillennialism or something, I'd like, oh, that wouldn't be as
checks out
to me. And that wouldn't bother me, I suppose. There may be like individual.
What I'm trying to do is figure out what you're squishy on.
Oh yeah,
no,
yeah.
I'm just kidding.
I don't know what I'm squishy on. I'm sure that I am. Nothing is coming immediately to mind. There's individual questions like working through, you know, working through the text, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, if somebody said, hey, your view of the Nephilim.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Or, like, if Paul's a believer in Romans 7 or not, you know.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Right. So, like, I don't think the Nephilim are the result of fallen angels and humans interbreeding or whatever. And I remember when I said that, like, at an elders meeting last year, a fellow elder, like, a guy that you know, I won't say his name on the head, but he was like, you don't? And I remember, I actually know
who it is.
I am old enough to remember when if you said
the other way,
you did believe that, somebody would be like, you believe that?
Yeah, like that's weird. Yeah.
Like that's right. Weird. And so it's not the weirdness I reject. I
try
to make a case
weird.
Based on like exegetical, you know. But if you said, hey, in 10 years, you're going to change your mind on that, I'd be like, okay.
Yeah, all right.
Checks out. Because I don't hold that so tightly.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Good.
But I don't know if I'm squishy about anything else.
No, you're solid.
Okay. I appreciate it. Yeah. I mean, I'm 50, so it's like at this point, a lot of stuff has kind of settled into the bedrock.
You heard it here. Bit. Jared will never change his mind.
I tried to be, 15, when I was going through the Reformed theology thing as a younger man, I tried to do the paedo baptism thing because I thought, this is the full expression of Reformed tradition. And so I'm going to explore that. And I just couldn't get there. I could never get there. And, and I tried. Like, it wasn't, I went into it wanting to disprove it and stay a credo Baptist.
Yeah, yeah.
I went in thinking, oh, this is probably the next step. It makes sense because all the guys I'm listening to are paedo Baptists, and the old guys that I'm profiting from are paedo Baptists. And so I saw, give me the best books, give me the best arguments. And I went in wanting to be convinced, and I just could not be convinced. I just couldn't come out as a paedo Baptist. So I don't, and if you told me today, I would say that's a fake Jared Wilson.
That's right. Yeah, like there's some where it's like if someone told me like, hey, you changed your mind on that, I'd be like, what happened?
Right.
What happens in year six that changes everything?
Right. But seismic shift.
We'll see if you change your mind about the Patriots going to the Super Bowl by the time this episode airs.
That's right. Yeah. See, my prediction comes true. I'm not a prosperity gospelist, but I want to manifest it. I want to name and claim this. I'm naming it and claiming it. Hey, if you enjoy the podcast, you're a listener, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you listen to or watch your favorite podcast. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church.